Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, but really presented this week by Ruth Jackson. Hello, Ruth.
Hello.
Very exciting that you are taking the wheel of this week's Unbelievable show.
I am. I must admit, I feel a little bit like a naughty school child sort of taking over while the teacher's away.
We'll see what happens. Tell us what's coming up on this week's edition of the show.
Yeah, so we've got a really exciting addition. So we've got Tim Alford, who is a Christian youth worker and father, and Hannah Timpson, who is a humanist studying sociology. And they're going to be discussing the question of whether raising your kids Christian is indoctrination. So lots of interesting things to say. They disagree quite strongly on that, as you can imagine. And it gets quite feisty, but in a very gracious way.
Well, I've had a chance to have a quick listen, and it does get feisty. And there's lots of things that are raised during the course of it on the Old Testament and whether Jesus existed, which inevitably Tim didn't necessarily have time to respond to. But we've got lots of shows in the back catalogue for anyone who wants to hear some good discussions on those issues. Lots to go and avail yourself of. Remember, you can find Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. You can find links to videos, the archive of podcasts, resources, and indeed, of course, make sure to check out the newsletter and ways to support the show as well. And by the way, if you're listening from the US or watching from the US, then check out unbelievable.show as well, which is a great place to go for further resources for the US and to support us from there. But for the moment, I'm going to hand it over to you, Ruth, and say, have a great show.
Thanks. Look after
it. I feel like I'm handing over my child to you for a week. It's going to be great. Thank you very much for standing in this week. And I look forward to listening.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
On today's show, we are going to be looking at whether raising kids Christian is a form of indoctrination. And I'm delighted to be joined today by humanist Hannah Timpson and Christian Tim Alford. Hannah is studying a master's in sociology at Exeter University, as well as being a classical singer. Hannah was raised in a Christian home, but she has since become a humanist. And she was even the president of Humanist Students, which is the student arm of Humanists UK. Now, Tim Alford is the national director of Limitless, which is the children and youth ministry arm of Elim Pentecostal churches in the UK and Ireland. And Tim is also a dad of two. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having us.
Very exciting. I also feel like I need to mention that Hannah is coming to us live from a bus where she lives.
That's right. Yeah.
So exciting. So cool. But Hannah, I would love to hear just a little bit about your story, because for the regular listeners of Unbelievable, you're probably not new to them. You've been on the show twice before, which definitely makes you more of an expert than me in this case. But you were on the show, I think it was April 2018, talking about the problem of evil with Sharon Dyricks. And then recently, July last year, talking with David Robertson, you were answering some questions, weren't you, from young people, kind of responding to their questions.
Yeah, that was fun.
Obviously, you as a humanist, David as a Christian apologist. But you sort of touched on some of your story. But for those of us who didn't hear that or don't know of your story, would you just share a little bit about what it was like growing up as a Christian, and I guess what it was that kind of drew you away from that and attracted you to humanism?
It's quite a long story, so I'll try and break it down a little bit. So I grew up in Hackney in East London, and my family is still there now. And I went to, well, growing up, my parents were both very Christian. My grandfather, who lived around the corner as well, was a Christian. We went to church in, like, just around the corner from our house, pretty much about 10 minutes down the road, at a Baptist church. And basically, for most of my childhood, I grew up in that church, and most of my community, everything that I did, I went to Sunday school, that sort of thing, was, you know, all surrounding the Christian story and, I suppose, the person of who is Jesus. So obviously, Baptist Christianity is a Protestant form of Christianity, but it was also kind of merged with Pentecostalism and that sort of thing as well, just because of the demographic of the part of the country that I'm in. There are a lot of people from Nigeria, for example, as part of the church. I went to a Church of England primary school, as most kids in the UK do. Say most of them, I don't know actually the demographics of that, but a good chunk of them, yeah. So yeah, we, you know, did a lot of, every day was daily worship. It's part of the law that that teaching has to be primarily Christian teaching, encouraging Christian spirituality in schools. And so that meant that every morning there was some sort of daily act of worship in my school, and I was very much a willing participant of that. And then I went on to a secondary school, which was Church of England. And actually, I didn't get into that secondary school to begin with, because that secondary school was a Church of England secondary school, and Baptists were apparently lesser or not as good as having a true Church of England person. So I managed to get into that on a waiting list. I was very much a willing participant in all of that. I was at church, while I was at church, I was part of the youth groups. I went to Bible studies, and I went on to study theology and religion at university when I was 21. So that kind of interest in religion and that sort of stuff has definitely not gone away. And I'm always been very interested in talking about, you know, the big questions and that sort of thing. I'm that kind of thinker. I kind of skip the small talk and end up on the deep questions. I remember being in a club once, and a friend of mine, we were chatting for all of a few seconds, and then I was like, so do you believe in God? And, you know, we got talking into that within, and he was like, how did you get from this to this within sort of 5 minutes? So I definitely have always been very, very interested in it. But in one, for me, I think I gave my life to Christ when I was 9, and then really continued and really truly believed it, I think, until I was about 17 years old. I started to sort of question it, because I'd met a boy who I was very interested in, and started seeing, and my parents were very much, you can't do this in my house, you're not allowed to be like X, Y, and Z, we don't like this person, blah, blah, blah. And obviously I was a 17, and I didn't like that very much. So I decided most of the time that I would spend my times at his place. And he was quite a stringent atheist, and definitely a lot more of a hardline atheist than I am. Very much had the belief that Christians and people who believed in what he deemed mythical things were perhaps stupid and irrational, which I don't think I agree with. But that definitely then sparked some questions within myself about what it was that I really believed. Because I think when I was younger, I never had the opportunities to ask the questions, really ask the questions. Because I believed that I did ask the questions that were important, and the answers, but the answers were always a little bit sort of fluffy, and they never really got to the point or really addressed the conversations that I was interested in having. And to be honest with you, I was quite comfortable in my life, and I just sort of accepted a lot of the things that were going on. So, but there were things like, you know, well, does God exist? And does God really exist? And I remember as a child, you know, I asked my mum, is there anything that God can't forgive? Is there any kind of like evil, you know, sin that's really, really awful? Because God obviously can forgive even murder, right? So, and mum said, like, it was, you know, turning your back on God was the one thing that you couldn't come back from, basically. And I do remember as a child being terribly frightened that I might have said something or rejected God in some way, and therefore not be able to get into, you know, the kingdom of heaven or whatever. So I do remember there are a lot of sort of fears around that sort of thing. So I remember I asked a question when I was 15 about the goodness of God and whether God could both be good and evil. And I think a lot of Christians have varying perspectives on that. And that's how I ended up, I think, talking to Sharon Dirks about good and evil and theocracy democracy, that sort of thing, a couple of years ago. But so, and the answer to that question when I was younger, when I was about 14, was, well, God is always good. God is good. And that, just accept it. God is good. And I think at the time I was just like, oh, okay. And I did just accept it. But then having these conversations with my then boyfriend, where actually the parameters of conversation were actually a lot wider, he was able to point things out about my life and about the things that I believed. And I obviously pushed back at him, but it just started the cogs whirring. And then I went to live with Amish people, which was obviously an experience. And I thought, actually, because I was terrified that I was losing my faith, actually, I got to a point where I thought, actually, is God there? I don't know. And me and my mum had talked, and this thing sort of appeared. Mum said that she'd prayed, and she said that maybe this would be the thing that saved your faith. It will make you kind of have direction in life. As you know,
that was for a reality television programme, wasn't it?
It was, yes. So it was for Channel 4. You can actually, I think it's on 4OD now. So if anybody is interested in going and watching it, it's called Living with the Amish. And I very much went on that show as the evangelical Christian one, you know, and I went in and I asked questions, and we did Bible studies with the Amish. And they read me things like, so the most difficult things, and I think a lot of perhaps Western Christians would struggle with is the place of the woman in the home. And actually, I mean, the older I've got and the more I've looked after my own house, the more I've kind of come to understand where they're coming from, and actually the comfort that they find in having those gender roles, even if I don't necessarily agree with it. So, I mean, so those are the things that really I've pushed back on initially, but that then really spiraled me into a place where I thought, there was a whole moment about, you know, is God really there? I don't feel like God's there. Then, you know, there's one of the Amish ladies who sort of gave me a hug and said, yeah, it does feel like he's very far away sometimes, doesn't it? And I said yes. And they kind of, that was, to be honest, I felt a shift in myself right at that moment, and that was captured on screen, so that was really interesting. And I was very pensive in that show. I was thinking a lot, and I came back and I didn't really address the question for a long time. I sort of was kind of living my life and getting on with things, but I didn't really go to church because I didn't feel particularly comfortable with it, and I didn't really feel part of the community. Then I went to go and see something called, I don't know if they were called Jesus Freaks, but the church had invited me along with some of the youth group to see a show, and it was a Christian band, and I stood there and everyone was there with their hands in the air, you know, like I probably would have been maybe a year or two before. And they were talking about all this stuff about picking up your cross and following Jesus. And I just at that moment felt like I was watching a show. So it was that sudden paradigmatic shift, whatever you call it, paradigm shift, anyway, that really in that moment. I've had a lot of my friends who are non-religious as well, who've left religion, go, yeah, I had that moment too. I just realized that I just didn't belong anymore, and that it just didn't make sense to me. And actually quite a lot of the things that were being taught were frankly abhorrent to me and quite terrifying. Then I went to study religion at university, and I was an atheist when I got there, but then I found a humanist community, which is the humanist student group that I ended up leading, and I found people who really truly accepted me for who I was, and somewhere I felt like I really belonged. And I think that there are a lot of non-religious people who don't need that kind of community, because they never had community to begin with, but for me it was a real comfort to have something that came along and said, actually, we're here for you too, and we accept you just as you are, and obviously we're going to challenge you about what you believe, and I love, you know, that's the kind of thing that I want to be part of. But yeah, I felt like I found a place that I really belonged, and so that helped me to then begin unraveling my, to be honest with you, indoctrination. So I, you know, been told all of these things that weren't up for question, you know, not even that they weren't up for question, I could question them, but the answers were always the same, and there would never seem to be like a, well, maybe this isn't true. maybe I'm not right about this, you know, and not just about religion, but about social things too. So like marriage and the fact that, so I, you know, I thought that by the time I was 25, I was going to be married and living in a house, not a bus, and I would have, you know, 3 or 4 children. I don't even think I want to have children now. I've, you know, there was a show a little while back that on Unbelievable about the antinatalists. And I'd say I put myself squarely in that camp. I really loved that show. It was really good. But that sort of logic and way of thinking was never even something that popped into my head. It was just like, oh, that's what, you know, these other debauched people do. And I really struggled. And even now I struggle to call myself an atheist because of the meaning of those words to me as a Christian. And there are still kind of things in my head that were put into my brain as a child, beliefs that are just sort of core beliefs about how to love, who to be, what to do with your life, that still, you know, and what money means, what family means, what love is, that still kind of pop up. And I believe that that was because I have been indoctrinated. Mm. And I think we're all indoctrinated in many ways in society. It's not just religion and Christianity that does that. But I do think, and we'll get onto that a bit later, I'm sure, that Christianity is perhaps, at least in Western society, one of the most dangerous ways that we and things that we can teach our children. It's taken me about 10 years to get to a point where I am how I am, and I am content, and I'm happy, and I'm at peace with myself. So I think that that brings us into sort of the dangers of indoctrination, but that gives you a kind of a fair background of who I was and where I came from. And I was very much in that camp. I was very much a Christian, and like many people, and you know, we can see the population of Britain, you know, they were saying 72% of 18 to 24 year olds are now non-religious. That doesn't mean they're humanists, but it means that they're, you know, definitely not Christian. quite a few of those people would have come from Christian backgrounds, yeah. And we're in a Christian society, really, you know. So what does that say about Christianity and about young people today? I think that's quite an interesting conversation to have as well. But I'm one of those, basically.
Well, and we'd hopefully get to talk a little bit about that in a bit, but thank you so much for sharing your story, Hannah. I know it's not easy talking about some of those things, but Tim, we'll obviously come back to parts of Hannah's story and we can kind of ask some questions about that, and you know, see where we kind of where you differ and where you agree. But in some ways, I suppose you had a kind of similar upbringing to Hannah in that you were also raised in a Christian family, but you have obviously come to quite a different conclusion as an adult in that you have stayed within the Christian faith. Would you just share a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, I was just thinking, actually, Hannah, as you were sharing, it's so many similarities in our stories, but ultimately I guess we've ended up in a very different kind of destination. So I like you, Hannah, was brought up in a Christian home. My parents weren't church leader. Well, my dad was an elder in our local church, not the vicar or the pastor, but you know, very much a Christian home, you know, taken to church in that way, you know, from year zero. And funnily enough, I was brought up in Exeter for the first 18 years of my life, where you're now studying, and I was on a reality TV show and singing, so loads of things in common as well. So anyway, I was brought up in a Christian home, and I was part of that in the way that you described, Hannah, was part of a youth group. And I guess the difference has been that, you know, I'm 36 years old now, and I just feel like I'm more in love with Jesus than ever. You know, even just this morning, sitting on my sofa, opening my Bible, spending some time with him, it's the best bit of my day every day. And I feel like his presence with me even now, even as we speak, each moment. And I guess I've asked the questions in the way that you have as well, Hannah, and I've wrestled with that. And of course, on my journey, there's been periods of doubt, but I never had that moment of rejection, I guess, in the way that that you had it. And just I guess I feel the reality of Jesus more now than I ever have, and I love him more now than I ever have. So I left home at 18 to do a Christian gap year. It's not a gap year thing anymore. It's a degree thing now, but it was at that time called Nexus Academy of Music Ministry, where I was studying music and the Bible at the same time. I had a couple of places at university, not to study theology actually, but to do music. One in London, one in Salford. And it turned out that God had a different plan. And I had started a band during my time there at Nexus, and the idea was it was only ever supposed to be just a little bit of fun for the year. You know, we'd write some songs, we'd play in some pubs, and you know, just have a nice time, and then off we would go to university. But it turned out that it was 9 years of our life touring around Europe. And yes, in part we did that because we loved music, and you know, it was an artistic expression in that sense. But more so, we did that because we love Jesus, and we wanted to use that opportunity to share the gospel and to share the love of God with people that might never step into a church building, that might never have another opportunity to hear it. That was when we did that reality TV show that I mentioned, Hannah, which was called Singing with the Enemy. And basically, we were there. I guess we were there on the same basis that you were there, Hannah, as the evangelical Christians, right? And the band that we were with were called Paparazzi Whore.
brilliant.
who self-described their genre as sleazy punk rock. And it was a, that's how they described it. And it was a very, I don't know how you found it, Hannah, but I found it to be an extremely intense experience, just being followed around with a camera, 24/7. But actually amazing things happened in the show. One of the things that the premise was, we were going to get together. They hoped that there would be fireworks and arguments and fights. and we had to try and write a song together, record the song together, and perform the song together. Mm-hmm. That was the premise of the show. One of the things that we had to do during the week was go and watch each other's shows. So they had a show in a bar in London. And it was a total setup how it happened with the producers. But essentially what happened is we went down the front, cheering them on, watching their show, and then they had some strippers come up on stage. And so at that point, the bar was like L-shaped. So we went round the corner so we could hear their music, but not watch what was happening on the stage. But we freaked out because we thought that, they could cut this in any way. They could cut us out up the front of the show, clapping and cheering, and then, do a jump cut to the strippers on stage. And so we were really, thankfully they didn't, they gave a more kind of honest cut than that. So we went to their show, and then they started having this big disagreement about, was that weakness or was that strength? Was it strength that we could stand for our convictions, or was it weakness because we couldn't watch it, without having our minds turned or whatever. So they started having a big argument from within about it. And then they came to our show, and actually we did our show back up at Nexus, where we had met and formed the band. And there was a moment in the show where I started reading from Romans 8 about how nothing can separate us from the love of God. And one of the singers in their band had what I would describe as a real encounter with the Holy Spirit, really just felt the love of God in a tangible way. So she, cutting a very long story short, she ends up leaving the band, saying, I actually think I'm more like the guys in Dweeb than I am like the guys of Paparazzi Whore, and asking, how do I find out more about Christianity? What do I need to do if I want to become Christian, all that kind of stuff. So it was this amazing thing that God did when we were on the show. So anyway, we did that for 9 years. After that time, I worked for a couple of years with an evangelist called Mark Greenwood, who taught me a load of great stuff. And then since then, for I guess 7 years now, I've been leading this ministry of Limitless. And so I've got two kids, Tobiah, who's 6 years old, and Aria, who is 4 years old, just started school just recently. She's doing really well. She's a fiery girl. So she keeps me in my place. But I say that to say, I guess kind of my whole life, Hannah, is kind of about trying to introduce young people and children to Jesus, whether that is, my own kids, or whether that's, the young people I work with in my youth group locally, or encounter nationally as I travel around and do various bits and pieces. So really, really looking forward to the conversation today, just hearing your perspective, Hannah. I'm sure it will be fascinating. I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot today.
Yeah, I think me too.
So Hannah, you mentioned kind of the sense in which you feel like you've been indoctrinated. I'm sure you wouldn't use as strong a language as Richard Dawkins has done when he on various occasions has called sort of bringing up children in a particular faith as tantamount to child abuse. But I wonder kind of, what do you think of that sense of bringing a child up in a way that I suppose they have no choice over whether they say yes or no to it? In some senses, yeah, like you say, is it indoctrination?
I think any form of indoctrination, and I would go as far as Richard Dawkins, frankly. And it's really hard, it's really difficult because my parents, when they brought me up in the Christian faith, and I'm sure that any parent more or less who brings their child up in a particular faith isn't intending to hurt the child. In fact, the complete opposite. What they're planning to do and trying to do is to, well, initially I think save their immortal soul as well as make their life better here, right? So it is difficult to use the word abuse, but I would very much want to put out that actually I do feel like a lot of the things that I have experienced since leaving the Christian faith, and the way that the time that it's taken me to heal from a lot of the stuff that I've been taught by Christianity about my self-worth and the fact that, for example, I am nothing without Jesus. I'm nothing without the love of God, which frankly, again, to me is narcissistic. It's a dangerous kind of love, and it's a love with double standards. You know, that kind of thing has had similar effects on me as I would expect to see in somebody who had experienced emotional, sexual, or even physical abuse. And so I do think that, you know, and I hate saying it's a lovely people, you know, but I do think that it is abusive. And it teaches people to self-abuse themselves as you get older, because you get taught sort of coping mechanisms. And one of your coping mechanisms is to have, for want of a better, you know, turn of phrase, an invisible being and beings, because of the, you know, at least from my part of Christianity, I believed in angels and demons as well as gods or God, you know, so there's this, all this stuff where you're always constantly being watched. Everything about your life is about one thing. And a lot of the, you know, this whole language of sort of emptying yourself, and then, you know, in calling God into yourself and taking up your cross and following Jesus and all that sort of language is about saying, really, and from my experience, what I found is it about saying, well, you as an individual without God doesn't matter. And your self-worth, you are only worth something if Jesus or God says that you are. And you are only worth something, for me, then that also extends, if you're only worth something if you have a husband or somebody who loves you. And it doesn't teach young people, I think, self-love. What it teaches you is to rely on other people whose love may be flawed. And I do believe that the love of Jesus or the love of God, you know, who in my opinion is quite barbaric, even, you know, if you read the Bible from cover to cover, it's not love. And you know, what kind of loving father, for example, would tell his son to kill his other, you know, son, like Abraham? I mean, you know, why would he do that? That is abuse. And that's, and if we are all like children, if we are all the children of God, then you know, God has a lot of explaining to do about the things that he did in the Bible. Why did he kill all the firstborn Egyptian children during, you know, during Moses' times? Not that I think Moses was a real person, but you know, even in the context of the story, if that's the kind of God that you're worshipping, and if that God is the same God as the God of Jesus, then yes, he is an abusive person. And I wouldn't, if I was in a relationship with a man who treated me in the way that God and Jesus were supposed to treat me, and the kind of flawed love that they have for me, then I would say it was abuse. So yes, I do agree with Richard Dawkins. I do think that teaching children to be uncritical and to just accept the love of Jesus in the way that most people do is child abuse.
Tim, I would love to hear you come back to that and maybe press into some of those specific issues. But we are going to go to a quick break. We're discussing really interesting things, whether bringing up children in a particular faith is indoctrination or even tantamount to child abuse. Got Hannah Timpson here and Tim Alford. But we're going to go to a quick break and we will be back soon.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second half of the show, where we are discussing whether bringing a child up in a particular religion or a particular worldview is tantamount to indoctrination or, worse still, child abuse. And just before the break, Hannah Timpson was saying that she agrees largely with Richard Dawkins that actually bringing a child up in a kind of uncritical approach to one specific religion is tantamount to child abuse. Now, Tim, as a child who grew up in a Christian family and a father, sort of intentionally with your wife, Jen, bringing your children up in the faith, I would hazard a guess that you would strongly disagree with that.
Yeah, shocker, I disagree. Yeah, and obviously take some issue with the intimation that I have been abused by my parents or am abusing my children. You know, from my own just personal point of view, I'm healthy. I'm mentally healthy, stable, have a strong, you know, sense of self-worth and personal identity. And I guess one of the things that, I mean, there's so many things in what you said there, Hannah, that I'd love to pick up on, and I won't be able to pick up on them all, time prevents us from doing so. But I think one of the things that's really interesting to me from what you picked up was the idea about worth and the value of human life and where that worth comes from. and how that value is ascribed, I guess. I think that's like a really interesting point that perhaps gets at some of the root of the issue here. So you'll have to forgive me because, I'll confess that I've had a little look into it, but I don't have a really in-depth understanding of humanism. But my understanding would be, correct me if I'm wrong, that essentially when it comes down to it, the central tenet would be about that intrinsic value of human life. Would that be a fair comment, or correct me on that if I'm wrong?
I think humanism in some ways, so we obviously accept that the life is meaningless, that actually human beings, as if we were to like take it down to the objective basis, everything is objectively meaningless and doesn't really mean anything. But okay, it's important if we want to see the growth and prosperity of the human race to see the worth of human beings. And I think that quite often within humanism, it's about individual self-worth as well as our worth within the community, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah. And I think my contention would be that is I would perceive that to be a really shaky foundation upon which to build a sense of personal value of worth. And the reason I say that is that, like, if we're just the byproduct of, I guess, biological, genetic, evolutionary chance, that means, we are here by accident. We don't have a purpose in that sense. We're just, it just so happened that the gene pool worked out in a certain way and it ended up with us. Whereas as a Christian, I would say, from the scripture that we're made in the image of God. I would say that, I'm chosen by God and precious to him. 1 Peter 2, I'd say that we're fearfully and wonderfully made. I would say that we've been knit together within our mother's womb, Psalm 139. And so which says I'm here on purpose. It's deliberate. I'm here not by accident, but by design. And to me, that ascribes a far greater value to humanity than something that is just, I guess, conjured up from within. And I think this is where it gets shaky, right? If we ascribe value to ourselves and to one another from within, then it follows that we can also withdraw that value from within. So I think by having an objectively an objectively ascribed value from something external, from something transcendent, it means that human life continues to have value whether we believe it does or not. And so with a Christian worldview, I would say stuff like child abuse, stuff like domestic violence, sexual abuse, even bullying can't be entertained because it demeans the value of another human. Whereas if we believe that we have the power to ascribe that value to another human, then we also have the power to devalue another human if it's all from within. So without an external, transcendent, objective reason to add that value to human life, all of those behaviors are now tenable. Slavery, prostitution, pornography, all of these kind of evils that demean a person, that make a person an object, that dehumanize a person, all of those become possible. But those evils cannot be allowed to stand when you have a objective sense of that worth, because if you believe that every human is made in the image of God, then whatever their color, whatever their class, whatever their creed, that person has value. Whether I believe they do or not is irrelevant because it's objective, it's transcendent, it's externally described. So I feel like that's a much more solid foundation to build value upon. So let me bring that into how then I would help a young person, say, who's in my youth group. We know that young people like struggle with their sense of self-worth and personal identity all the time, and they believe that they themselves have no value. If then their value is internally, ascribed, then what? I can't help them. Like, if you have the power to ascribe value to yourself or take it away, then what can I say to you? I mean, you feel like you're worthless, you have no self-esteem. But if I can say, actually, there's a truth that transcends what you feel, and that truth is that however you feel about yourself right now, that you are made in the image of God, that you're chosen by God, that you're precious to him, that you're fearfully and wonderfully made, and whether you feel it or not, you have value for that reason. I think then that stuff doesn't change. It doesn't shift according to how that child or that young person feels, which is why I have no hesitation in saying that to them, because I feel like it's a much sturdier, more immovable foundation upon which they can build their own sense of self-worth and personal identity. So
yeah, it makes sense. I feel like I want to come back on the, you know, if the whole thing of, like, for example, sexual abuse, prostitution, all of that is tenable within a society that doesn't have God. I think that actually, if you look at the Bible, a lot of people within the Bible, with God's blessing in some regards, were taking part in those actions. I mean, even some of the rules in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, you know, are pro-slavery, are pro using people. I mean, because obviously the narrative of the Old Testament are that these Israelites are the chosen people of God. And of course, you can argue that perhaps when Jesus came, he came for everyone. He came to die for the Gentile as well as the Jew. But then you then have to think about, well, why did the nature of God change? Why did he care about people? Because if God is not the same today, yesterday and today, and his nature doesn't change, then why did he feel like it was okay to have a chosen group of people who he loved more than anything in the world, and to use everybody basically, and I know why, you know, if we're talking about it theologically or even historically or politically, why that narrative would be told that these people were far more important than all of the other people within the vicinity that they were living in. You know, they God treated people as if they were bargaining chips, as if they didn't matter. And I do think that the God of the Old Testament, and if you think he's the same God as the Old Testament as in the New Testament, allowed those sorts of things to happen and did see people as kind of meaningless pawns in his kind of war game, and played with people and used people and abused people. So if I'm made in the image of God, I'm also made in an image that then allows those things to happen too. And you know, and also, I mean, you know, people talk about a cosmic child abuse if he's doing it to his own son, which is complicated because he is his son and his son is him. But you know, the idea that he allowed God this horrible image of, and you know, if it really happened, to die for the sins of the world, he also allowed us to fall into sin, but then blamed humanity for the sins of man. And I find the narrative of Adam and Eve, or you know, the creation story, to be quite scary, because it then puts on, you know, well, I as a 5-year-old was a sinner because I had stolen some sweets or whatever. And even that, I was a sinner simply because I was born into this world. I was born fallen, I was born broken, and I needed God to save me. And that is the narrative that the majority of people I know are taught and teach. And that quite often, and I hate to say it as a, again, to really nice people and to people who mean well. And I think that often, quite sometimes, abuse happens by people who mean well. You know, people aren't often going out there to be nasty and abuse people. And they are often made with good intentions, but going out there to target vulnerable people who often feel lost and often don't have that their self-worth in themselves. And that does happen with teenagers and children, although a lot, you know, maybe under the age of 7, children tend to have a lot more self-confidence. And I think that society, it's not just, you know, a religious thing, will play into how teenagers grow up, and they lose sometimes that self-worth. I do agree with that. But then if you were to tell them that they need God and they need Jesus in order to feel important and in order to feel like they have meaning, then I think that you're mistaken. And we also need to remember that it doesn't, all of the promises of an objective truth mean nothing unless you can prove it. And quite often we're going out there and we're telling children and we're telling young people that this is the truth, this is, you know, Jesus, the way, the truth and the life, and not really explaining why, and often falling back on emotion, because young people are very emotional. I remember when I was a teenager, like, everything felt 10 times bigger and 10 times more exciting. And all of, you know, I remember going to Soul Survivor and experiencing what I would now call mass hysteria when I won't say his name, but the guy who was leading the show would be, because it kind of was a show, would be like, the spirit is coming, I feel the spirit, can you feel the spirit? And then people would start crying over here and wailing and laughing in the spirit. hear it, but actually what it was, and it's a phenomenon that happens across the globe, not just at religious experiences, is mass hysteria. That's, I think, I mean, it's possible amongst adults, but it's far more possible amongst young people who feel things far deeper than other people. And I do think that that makes them a vulnerable target for people. And I don't think that you're going out there or a lot of evangelicals are going out there with the intention of harming anybody. Not at all. In fact, probably the opposite. But what happens is you then take away their self-importance without the love of God and without the fact. So I can, as a humanist, I can accept, yeah, really, I don't mean anything. My life is meaningless. But then within society, I mean something. Society gives me my meaning, and we talk to each other and we come to a sort of social agreement, a social contract about, and so therefore, why would I murder or rape or anything like that? You know, it doesn't make sense. Yes, everything is possible because there is no cosmic justice afterwards. But that doesn't mean that in this life, I actually want to go out and commit those acts. It just doesn't make sense because we're social creatures, you know?
Tim, so. Sorry, I feel like there's so much in there. Do you want to just quickly respond just a little bit to what Hannah was saying? But then I'd love to, if you don't mind, get down to the heart of like why you don't think it's indoctrination to bring your children up with those things, if that's okay, Tim.
I guess one nuance that I just want to kind of, I guess, correct there a little bit, Hannah, is that I'm not saying that without God, you don't have value. I'm not saying that if you don't have a relationship with God, you are no longer a human that has value. What I'm saying is that whether you feel it or not, you have value, and whether you believe it or not, you have value, because you have been created on purpose, for a purpose. You're here by design. You're made in the image of God. And that is unaffected by what you believe about it, or, you know, whether or not you choose to believe it. I just believe that is true of you. That's true of every human, whether they would call themselves a Christian or a person of faith or an atheist or an agnostic or a humanist or whatever. That remains true. So I'm not saying that somebody's worth is dependent upon what they believe about God. I'm saying that their worth is there because they are a son, a daughter, a created, designed on purpose person here for a reason. That's, I guess, a slight nuance as how I would see it.
So I suppose in your sense then, Tim, you see Christianity and belief in God as a good thing, which is why you would bring your children up in that.
I mean, there's almost kind of three perspectives, I guess, I have on this. The first, I guess, Hannah's already intimated towards, which is that, you know, so with my kids, I do not hesitate to teach them to brush their teeth, or to, you know, look before they cross the road, or to eat their vegetables, or to manage their screen time. And I don't hesitate to do that because as a father who loves my kids, I ultimately want what is best for them. And I know that those things are good for them. And so that means that I cannot be, to be a loving father, I cannot be passive about whether or not they brush their teeth. I can't just let them work out for themselves, you know, if they're going to look before they cross the road. Because if I was, I would be an highly irresponsible parent. It's my duty as a father to teach them those things because they are for their good. And I believe that what they believe about Jesus will have an infinitely greater impact on them than you know, their diet or their screen time or their teeth brushing routine, because Jesus came to give them life in its fullness. And so because I believe that to be true, I have to teach my kids about it. It's incumbent upon me. I mean, what kind of parent would I be if I believed that something was for the good of my children, actually the highest good, and I chose not to teach it to them? I couldn't do that. Like, so I am compelled to bring them up in the way of Jesus because I love them.
I don't mind if you don't mind me jumping in. I understand that it's love, and a lot of parents do things for their children out of love. But, you know, this sounds awful, but we have social services for a reason, because parents don't always know what's best for their children despite loving them. And wouldn't it be better? I mean, so using the analogy of free will, for example, I'm often told that we have, I mean, I don't actually really believe in free will. I'm a determinist. But say we take the Christian, like, liberal perspective of free will, and we say, you know, well, God gave people free, well, God gave Adam and Eve free will in the Garden of Eden because he loved them so much that he wanted them to make choices for themselves, whether to choose his way or their way. And the trouble that the problem that I have with a lot of Christians, not all Christians, there are a lot of Christians who allow their children to experience lots of other things and don't tell them that Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, and without them, they would go to hell or whatever. But there are, you know, for the vast majority of Christians, that's what they do and what they believe. And they tell that to their children out of love. My parents love me very much. And it's not that they're trying to be nasty by not giving me much of a choice, to be honest with you. And I don't even know whether they noticed that they weren't giving me a choice. But enrolling me in a Church of England school, enrolling me in unlimited, you know, Bible studies and church groups and things, you know, and I did go to secular things. I went to, you know, did drama and music that wasn't specifically targeted at Christian children. I did do that. But the majority of my time was spent with people who believed in Christianity, who agreed with what my parents were teaching me or agreed with what I then believed and what I then accepted. And I was constantly surrounded by that. So actually it wasn't a choice. And I know what you're saying is, you know, well, if I believe that this is going to save their eternal soul, then why would I not do it? I completely understand that. But the point I'm making is, as a loving father, would it not be better to allow your children to choose God, not to enforce it? And enforce sounds really dramatic, as if you're like strapping their hands behind their back and, you know, telling, you know, pointing a gun at their head and telling them that they must believe in Jesus or else. That's not how indoctrination works. But would it not be better for your children to experience life, to talk to different people, to be able to use the brain that God gave them, if God exists, to rationalize? And I think that, you know, well, I mean, in Britain, we have the age of criminality is 10, and the age of reason is roughly about the same age. Wouldn't it not be better to then introduce it to them when they're a little older, so that they don't just develop positions where it, like, sort of self-beliefs that are just self-fulfilling, if that makes sense? So they are able to be exposed to different beliefs, different cultures, and allowed to think for themselves, basically. And yes, as little children, we are told, you know, to clean our teeth because it's good for us, and not to cross the road, you know, when there's a car coming, and to look twice, you know, and that's important. But I also think it's important to develop critical thinking so that children don't just lap up dangerous and often, well, if they were older and allowed to reason, able to reason and critically thinking, they wouldn't accept them.
Yeah. Tim, obviously, you're a youth worker. You've been a youth worker for years as well as a dad. You obviously would, I imagine, think that it's important for young people to think critically rather than just kind of swallow absolutely what you think. So do you want to just say a little bit about how you do that with your children?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I, you know, indoctrination, as I understand it, would be teaching somebody to accept a set of beliefs uncritically. Mm-hmm. I don't want my children to do that. Perhaps, ironically, you might suggest, because I think if they accept it uncritically, that's actually a really weak foundation for a life of following Jesus, because they won't have asked robust questions. And so when the time comes that the, you know, if I've sheltered them or hidden them from wrestling with the big questions, then, you know, when the time comes that they which it would already be the case, I guess, that they are faced with different views from my own, their faith will just unravel because they've never been able to ask this question. So I want them to dig deep. I want them to reflect critically. You know, Tobias, my eldest, he's only 6. So the level of that questioning is limited, of course, at the moment, but he still asks questions. And I would never say, oh, just accept it, you know, as you suggested earlier, Hannah. I would happily engage in that dialogue and share my perspective and what I would understand. I'd happily say, oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't know, because I don't believe myself to be the oracle of knowledge. And there's plenty of things that I don't know. And he is exposed to a whole variety of world views through his friendships, through his school, through his football club that he goes to, you know, twice a week, and so on and so forth. And so, yes, I do want them to engage with it critically, but ultimately my conviction is, my deep conviction is that it is for their good. And so for that reason, I don't have any hesitancy in being persuasive and effusive about the relationship I have with Jesus. Why would I not want to share that with them? It's absolutely transformed my world and continues to transform my world, you know. And I guess I would say this, Hannah, even if I was to bring them up neutral, like I won't say anything to them about God, they can just be exposed to different worldviews as those worldviews expose themselves. Firstly, they won't be exposed without bias, because our culture has deep bias on a whole load of things, some of which I'd agree with, some of which I wouldn't. So it's not, it's never neutral. It's never neutral. Mm. And secondly, the other thing I would suggest is that even if I wanted to bring them up like that, that is still a worldview. That is still a belief system. That's still a set of beliefs, even though that set of beliefs is neutral about God and the reality of God and Jesus and his involvement in our lives and who Jesus is or was, if you don't believe, you know, he rose from the dead, then even if I brought them up in that way, I'm still imposing, if you want to use that language, a worldview of one kind or another upon them. It's no less or more a worldview or a set of beliefs than my Christian worldview or set of beliefs. So to me, the argument isn't about whether or not you can impart a worldview on a child, because it's just, it's not possible to not do that. So I think the argument really is about the validity of the worldview,
right?
Rather than whether or not you impart a worldview on a child, because every parent does that just by how they live. They do that.
Right. I agree with you. I think that.
I'm sorry, Hannah. I know you want to come back on that. Is there any chance that we could go to a quick break first? And we'll get Hannah to respond to that. Just that idea of like, there's no such thing as neutral. And I suppose if you're not raising them in a Christian worldview, you will be indirectly raising them with the prevailing secular worldview, whatever it is that they're kind of being exposed to. So we are going to go to a quick break. We're having such an interesting discussion about whether raising children in a particular faith is tantamount to indoctrination or child abuse. Do not go anywhere, because in a few minutes we will be back with Hannah Timpson and Tim Alford.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Ruth Jackson, sitting in for Justin Brierley. And thank you to those of you who listened to our live stream with Professor Alistair McGrath last week. Thank you too for your brilliant questions. We've had a message in from the wonderful Brian Broderson, who actually hosted the US Unbelievable Conference last year in Costa Mesa in California. He says this: thank you for this excellent Q&A with Alistair McGrath. I so appreciate his brilliance, wisdom and humility. I can't wait to read his new, and hopefully not his final, book. We'll hear more of your feedback towards the end of the programme, but still to come tonight, you can hear The Profile. And this week, it features two musical guests. In the first part of the show, we will hear from singer-songwriter Chris Eaton, and the second half of the programme will focus on the gospel singer Jekylline Carr. The Profile is on at 8 p.m. tonight, or you can listen on the Profile podcast. And next week on Unbelievable, Justin will be back to discuss conversion and deconversion. One of his guests will be Jana Harmon, who has recently completed a PhD focusing on atheists who have become Christians. And Jana will be joined by Joel Furchess, who has been studying the phenomenon of deconversion. I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating discussion, so do tune in at 6 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio next Saturday, or via the Unbelievable podcast or YouTube channel. And if you haven't had a chance to check out our Pathios blog yet, you can do that by going to pathios.com/blogs/unbelievable. That's Pathios, pathios.com/blogs/unbelievable. Our most recent blogs cover a variety of different topics, including whether Christians should vote for Donald Trump and why American commentator Dave Rubin is no longer an atheist. But for now, let's get back to the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the third and final part of the show, where we are discussing the important question of whether raising children as Christians is tantamount to child abuse or indoctrination. And just before the break, Tim was talking about why he brings his children up as Christians. And one of the things he was saying was that he does it because he thinks it's good for them. It's for their benefit. It's true. And it's what he wants them to grow up believing. And Hannah, I don't know what you think about that sort of sense in which religion is good for you. It's useful. It's helpful. So there was a research, and there's been lots of research, but there was a research back in 2018 that Harvard researchers did around how religion actually helps aid the mental health and physical health of children. I don't know whether there's anything you have got to say about that, Hannah, and whether you think it is good for children. And I suppose even if it is good for children, whether that's something we should do. Sorry, Tim, you should.
Yeah, Ruth, I just want to, there's something you said, bringing your children up as Christians, and that is actually a really helpful clarifying point, because that isn't what I'm trying to do. So I feel like my role as a parent is I want to introduce them to Jesus. They make a decision about whether or not they want to be a Christian. Like, I think that's actually really significant in the conversation. Like, I'm not raising them like with like a set of doctrines, believe this. I just want to introduce them to Jesus and then let them make a decision about who he is. That ultimately is what it's about. And I think that's quite different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is a really helpful clarification. Okay, so Hannah, clarifying those terms, Tim's not bringing them up as Christians. He's bringing them up to perhaps one day make that decision because he thinks it's good for them. So what would you say to that, Hannah?
It's difficult because, like I say, all parents bring their children up in different ways. And you're quite right, Tim. Like, if I was to have children, I would bring them up with certain biases. We all do. We all have biases that it would be biased of me to disagree with that. That's very true. But I think that there are ways that we can bring our children up to be healthy and happy, and to realize that they are okay on their own and as they are. And I think you're also right about, you know, when it comes to how helpful is this belief system that I'm giving to my children. And I suppose what you're saying is I often have conversations with Christians who say, well, I'm not a Christian, I just have a relationship with Jesus, which for me is just another way of them saying that they are a Christian, but trying to make it sound a bit more secular.
I'm a Christian. I'm not ashamed of that.
But I mean, that was sort of something that I was taught to say as a teenager as well. I think it kind of became part of the language. So I have a relationship with Jesus. I'm not a Christian, because the idea of that is about dogma, and you know, you can do this and you can't do that and blah blah blah.
Okay.
I think that you're quite right that dogma is the thing that is most dangerous. But obviously believing in Jesus and the things that came with Jesus have a sort of a set of dogma as well. Sort of a kind of, if you want to follow Jesus, you have to do a certain things, and you have to, I say have to, you have to believe certain things, right? So there is dogma that comes with it. So in knowing the person who is Jesus and accepting, and hopefully, I suppose, in your perspective, accepting Jesus as their Lord and Savior, they have to accept kind of a list of things that go along with that, and the transformation, like you say, that might bring, right? And to be happy and open to that. So I suppose you can't really separate the two. And I think that often modern Christians and more evangelical Christians like to do is to reword stuff and make it seem like there are less rules than there perhaps are, which is why I quite like talking to Catholics, because Catholics in some way have a list of like, this is what I, you know, this is what I believe, this is what I do, this is what it means to be a Catholic, more or less, right? I mean, it depends on the Catholic. And then the Christianity that perhaps you and I grew up in is a lot more fluid, and the rules seem to be a lot less out there, even though there are rules. And I actually find that is quite dangerous.
What you're kind of intimating towards, Hannah, which I 100% agree with, is that to be a Christian, or to be like a follower of Jesus, I would describe myself as a disciple of Jesus, isn't just about believing in Jesus. It's about following the way of Jesus. So I totally agree with you that if I put my trust in Jesus, and if I say I want to be your follower, it's not just about I believe that you died on the cross for me and that I'm forgiven and that you rose again, and that means that I can have life and that means that I can have a relationship with God. It's not just that. I totally agree. It's about, I like to describe it as, you know, I'm called to be who Jesus would be if Jesus were me. Like, I want to be as much like Jesus as I possibly, I want to live like Jesus. I want to do the things he did, say the things he said. I want to believe the things he believed. I want to follow in the way of Jesus. And so I totally agree, Hannah, with that point. It's not just a belief system. It is a way of life. It is a way of life. I absolutely agree. I guess my question would be, Hannah, if tomorrow the world was reset and suddenly everybody followed that way of Jesus, do you think the world would be a better place than it is now?
I think the problem is that we don't really know what the way of Jesus is. And there are okay, so if you look at the world, right, there are something like 40,000 different denominations of Christianity across the world, and it might be 45,000, and those people all have different interpretations of what it means to follow Jesus, what it means to follow the way, and they all teach their children that way, and they all teach their children, I mean, not all of them, but that this person over here, for example, if they, you know, who perhaps maybe is a Jehovah's Witness, they're doing it wrong, they're following the way of Jesus wrong. And I think that actually, if God was real, and if Jesus had existed or does exist in the way that a lot of Christians believe that he does, there would be a much clearer message, and there would be a much clearer way to follow. And the gods of the Old Testament and the New Testament wouldn't be so different if they're the same people. And so I do struggle. I think that if we were all to follow Jesus, we would still, because we're human beings, do it wrong.
And, I hear
do you know what I mean? It's not possible to fully interpret something literally just from biblical texts. And, you know, and I think obviously you perhaps believe that you know, have a relationship with Jesus beyond the Bible, right? But that's all, again, personal. That's all, again, something, you know, and perhaps you would discuss it amongst your church members and with people that you know who are also Christians about what it is to follow Jesus. I definitely did that. But, you know, again, we would definitely all have different ways of following Jesus. And so I can't say that I think that it would make the world a better place or not. It would really depend on your interpretation of the biblical text, as it has through history and society. People have interpreted the text and interpreted the words of Jesus incredibly differently.
I mean, for me, Hannah, ultimately, when you get down to it, you know, the way of Jesus is about loving God and loving other people as you love yourself. And I can't help but feel like if we all did that, the world would be a better place. We wouldn't have war. We wouldn't have abuse. We wouldn't have poverty even. Like, the way I see the way of Jesus is, because there is an authority that is greater than what I feel within me. So I feel like one of the massive, massive issues in our society right now, and the reason for so much of the pain and the evil that we have, is because we have made what is within us the ultimate authority. But when what is within us is the ultimate authority, it gives us carte blanche to do whatever feels right. And actually, we need something transcendent. We need something objective. We need something unifying where everyone can eventually say, actually, you know what? That might feel right for you, but it isn't. It isn't. Because it's not for the good of you, and it's not for the good of others. When I think about the way of Jesus, what I think about, you know, what I see Jesus teaching, and what I understand as I read the scripture again and again, it's about grace, and it's about gentleness, it's about kindness, and it's about patience, and it's about learning the secret of being content, and it's about, you know, it's about the mind controlled by the spirit, which is life and peace. It's about preferring one another above yourself. It's about generosity. It's about giving to people who in need when it costs me something. It's about the widow and the orphan, and it's about being peacemakers, and it's about, you know, being overflowing with hope. And Jesus said, you know, I have told you these things so that your joy may be complete. And so for me, I guess what I'm saying and what I'm asking, Hannah, is if that's how I'm trying to bring up my kids, and if that's how I'm trying to share Jesus and the way of Jesus and following Jesus with my young people, even if I'm wrong about the reality of God, where is the harm?
Because it's about, I think, that in the same way that there is a shame for certain people who grew up in a society that reject gay people, for example, where they don't feel like they belong, or where perhaps they don't agree with their elders and their parents or whatever, in a similar way with religion, when people then leave that religion or make different choices for themselves, they then feel shame and concern about who they are as people. They lose their identity. They don't have supportive, loving parents who then aren't. So my mum is, you know, at least she's got to a point now where I think she's stopped doing it. But I've found it's in some ways super offensive. In my birthday cards or in my Christmas cards, she would always be like, "He is risen, he is alive." And I'd be like, "That's really nice, mum. I know you believe that, but stop trying to enforce your views onto me. That, like, I am happy the way that I am, and I'm much happier. In fact, I'm much more at peace." And all of the things that you're talking about, which you know, obviously what you're saying are the fruits of the spirit, right, are part of humanist principles as well. And we can come to conclusions about what is good for one another, not just by some 2,000-year-old book or some, you know, God in the sky that we can have hardly see, but we can do it. We have over centuries done it by trial and error, and we have discovered what is good for mankind. We have discovered what is good for each other, and we continue to discover it. You know, things like conversations about things like euthanasia, or even, you know, the conversation that they were having on Unbelievable before about antinatalism and whether actually how giving birth to sentient life is good or not. I mean, that's a whole other ball game. Those are things that we do through conversation with each other and come to conclusions with through science and reason, and not necessarily by faith and following a book that was written by men and then changed over the last 2,000 years by men who, again, as you would say, and most people would say, are fallible, and then interpreted in different ways by different leaders of churches and that sort of thing, and then taught to our children in variant ways.
There's a whole podcast in there again. Tim, I'll let you come back on what you were going to say, but we're really pushed for time, so do you want to say what you want to say, and then we'll just have a quick talk about the sort of statistics that vary, but most people tend to say that around 70% of children and young people will lose their faith when they get into kind of their late teens. And I suppose the question is, if that is the number and so many young people are losing their faith, I mean, the sense of why is a whole other podcast in and of itself. But I guess it is the question, if they're going to be sort of leaving it anyway, is it indoctrination, or is it partly because we've indoctrinated them and therefore they're leaving? But Tim, why don't you say what you were going to say, and then we can
I was just going to ask a question, actually, Hannah, because I'd just be really interested to know, obviously, as somebody, I mean, you used to call yourself a Christian, and you studied theology and all that, and I'd just be really interested to know, like, what your perception is of who Jesus, I'm going to say, was, because I'm going to assume you don't think he rose from the dead, because if you did, you'd be a Christian. But, like, so who was Jesus? Like, what's your perspective on his life, and how do you understand that?
And obviously, I mean, so most historians do believe, obviously, that Jesus was real. But even if he wasn't, the narrative, the myth of Jesus is quite important, and has been quite important to societies all over the globe for a long time. I think that the person of Jesus, if he was real, yes, was at that time quite a revolutionary figure. I agree. And I don't think that he was necessarily a bad person or like necessarily a bad influence in that society. It was quite a difficult society to be in. But myths that kind of reflect the story of Jesus have existed for centuries before Jesus Christ, born on the 25th of December, died and rose again, that sort of thing. This just happened, in my opinion, to be the myth that was picked up by the people at the time and run with. So I don't know. I think that the person of Jesus wasn't necessarily a bad person or necessarily a good person either, but he was a revolutionary and a freedom fighter. Yeah, so I don't have a problem with Jesus himself. What I have a problem with is if he is the same God as the God of the Old Testament, then we've got problems, because the God of the Old Testament was nasty.
A whole other podcast.
It really is.
Could we just have some sort of final concluding remarks then? Tim, go for it.
Yeah. You know, I was really interested when Hannah said earlier that there was a moment where you went to see a band or something or to a worship service or something, and it was like, suddenly you felt like you were watching a show, and that was like quite a critical moment for you. And I can't help but wonder, you know, I'm thinking about a lot in these days, if the reason what, you know, we're seeing some of that with young people is because we've created all of these great, you know, events and programs and essentially, Hannah, shows, but what we've not been so good at is, you know, like I was saying, I was trying to do with my kids, just introducing children and young people to Jesus himself, to have, not just hear about Jesus, but to actually meet him personally. You know, that there's a story in Mark chapter 10 about Jesus and children, and the, you know, people are bringing children to Jesus, which essentially is, as a parent, is what I'm trying to do. And the disciples try and stop them. So no, this, yeah, they try and turn them away. They try and send them away. But, and then it says in the scripture that Jesus was indignant. It's like really strong language. And then it says, let the little children come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. And so for me, whether it's in youth work, whether it's in parenting, that's just what I want to do. Jesus is just so good, and he's so kind, and I just love him so much. I just want to say, let me show you what I've seen. Let me introduce you to what I've experienced, not secondhand, you know, but firsthand. And I guess if I was to say it like a concluding thought, which I guess is kind of relevant to these days, it would be this: like, if you or I, you know, discovered in these days like a coronavirus vaccine, we would feel absolutely compelled to spread the word about that. You know, if we were a good and moral person, which I'm sure we all are, like, the thing we could not do, we would not allow ourselves to do, would be to take and keep that cure for ourselves. If we were good and moral, we would feel compelled to do everything that we possibly could, not to be passive about it, but actually to persuade as many people as we could to take that cure. Well, what I believe in the depths of my gut as a follower of Jesus is that I found something that is much better, much more significant than a COVID cure. Like, it's a cure for death, essentially. But it's not just that. It's not just about the present. It's about the future. It's about the now. It's the cure for loneliness and purposelessness and brokenness and guilt and shame, and it's an invitation to wholeness and fullness of life. And so I guess it's like, how could I possibly keep that to myself? Like, as a loving parent, how could I not tell that to my children? I would say it would be immoral for me to be quiet about that. It'd be selfish for me to be quiet about that. And so because I believe that right in my gut, you know, because I've had the experience, examined the evidence, and I find what I believe to stand up to robust interrogation, and I've experienced it to be true and experienced the value of it, well, that's why I've dedicated my life to introducing others to Jesus.
Hannah, final thoughts?
So I think that you were talking about young people leaving the church in droves, and they really, really are. And, you know, people, I've seen Christians, Christian evangelists, terrified of this fact and going after, you know, young people in particular, because they think that, and I understand, you know, like you say, Tim, if you believe that you've got the truth, then you're going to want to share it with people. But I think that children's minds are so, and young people's minds, but particularly young children, they're, you know, they're so sort of soft and likely to take on what our parents tell us. You know, I used to believe most children, they believe that there are, you know, if they're monsters under the bed, for example, a parent's job is to tell them that that's not real. But my parents definitely told me that there were demons, you know, but as well as angels to protect me, things like that, you know, and that sort of stuff actually terrifies a child. But I believed it, you know, not just because I still asked questions within that frame, but my parents so solemnly believed it, and, you know, truly wanted me to follow what they believed, that I did, and I accepted it for all of my life. And actually, when you say that Christianity is a cure for shame, and following Jesus is a cure for yeah. shame and pain, and yeah. and brings joy and hope and loneliness, stops people from being lonely, I don't necessarily think that that's true. In fact, I found a lot of people who still experience those things, regardless of whether they believe in God or not, and actually then have to cope with that once they leave their faith, because actually sometimes it's a sticking plaster. Faith is a sticking plaster for the things that actually are hurting us in life, and people have to take time to come to terms with all of the things that the religion has kind of placed a plaster over, and haven't really dealt with it. So I do think that it's really difficult, and I understand, again, you know, that people do nasty things with good intention. And I think that it is extremely important to give your children choice, to teach them to be critical, and to teach them that they are okay and worth something just as they are. And yes, it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing to introduce them to what you believe necessarily. We are all biased. But I do think that children should be taught to be kind. The golden rule, you know, almost every religion, every worldview in the world has a golden rule. And it's in some ways similar to what happens, what said in the Bible, love, you know, love others as you love yourself and love God or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. So I don't think that you necessarily need religion in order to teach children to be happy and to have good morals. And I think what's happening now, you know, young people are leaving the church and other religions in droves because we have access to the internet. We no longer have to rely on authority. You know, we can read for ourselves and make up our own minds. And this is where it comes to the point where we really need to make sure that people have good critical skills so that they don't just take on any which fact they find on the internet. Yeah. Or join any kind of group that they think perhaps gives them meaning and joy in life. Otherwise, that's how you end up with, unfortunately, terrorists. And you end up with people who believe that the world is flat, and you end up with people who
like the QAnon and stuff and all of that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. who are uncritical about the world because they've just, that's the way that they've been taught to think. And I think that teaching children religion and saying that this is the truth, and just, you know, sort of, I'm not saying that you don't encourage your children to question, but if you believe it with such conviction, right, that they would feel ashamed to say, oh, Dad, I actually don't believe this anymore. This isn't right for me. I want to go my own path. That they would feel shame. And that's how I felt when I spoke to my parents about it. My parents would say to me, well, why do you have to tell people about humanism? Why do you have to talk about humanism? It's not a great worldview, is it? And I'd say, well, actually, I found contentment and happiness here. Why can't you just be happy that I'm happy? And I understand that my parents think I'm going to hell, right? They think that whatever hell means to them, that I am dead in my sin, right? And they want to save me. But I'm happy and I'm content with who I am. And I'm much more at peace than I ever was when I was a Christian. And I think that it's important to allow children to think for themselves and develop those critical thinking skills. And I think that placing your religion on them and the expectation that they then follow your religion and the disappointment that comes with them not choosing the path that you want for them is ultimately extremely damaging. And I do think that it is indoctrination.
Unfortunately, that is all we've got time for today. I feel like this could go on for hours, and it probably would if we could. But unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. Maybe there's some more podcasts in the back pocket. But just to say thank you so much to Hannah Timpson and Tim Alford for joining us today. I'll make sure that there's links in the podcast and things like that so people can find out more about you. But thank you so much for just such a gracious and interesting conversation. Hope you enjoyed that discussion. We would love to hear your thoughts. Do you think that bringing up children in a particular faith is tantamount to child abuse? Do get in touch with your thoughts via email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can get in touch through social media. You can find our Facebook page at facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or you can get hold of Justin or I on Twitter. You can find me at Ruth J. Jackson or Justin at unbelievablejb. Thank you so much to everyone who has been in touch with feedback about previous programmes. There's also a great message here that came to Justin's Instagram from Godson Danso. And it says, I'm a Christian from Ghana, West Africa. I really love listening to your podcast because it causes me to examine my faith and to know how to intellectually present the gospel to thinkers and to also know how to evangelise Muslims. I learned a lot about the advances of AI from your interview with Nigel Cameron and John Lennox. I totally agree that the church must get involved so that we can shape the future according to the plan and purposes of God. Because of this, I have prayerfully decided to pursue a career in computer science. God bless you greatly. Well, thank you so much, Godson, for getting in touch. And so exciting that you're going to be studying computer science. I know it was a while ago now, but we've had a comment in about the Trump debate. So that was Eric Metaxas and David French arguing about whether Christians should or shouldn't vote for Trump. And depending on when you're listening to this, the US election is just in a couple of days' time. This is a message from Ben Hearn, I think, which came in through Twitter, and he says, I love @unbelievablejb. I cannot recommend it enough. This debate is worth watching for anyone wanting to hear passionate defences for Trump and Biden. And just a little reminder that we've also got a Pathos blog, which kind of summarises David French and Eric Metaxas's points. So if you head to the Pathos blog, it's pathos.com/blogs unbelievable. You'll be able to find a kind of top tips for whether to vote for Trump or Biden there as well. A few people have got in touch about last week's Alistair McGrath live stream. There was a few comments coming through on the Facebook page as the live stream was on. So Lisa Rago says, this is an awesome discussion. Krishnam Raju Akula says, hello, Justin and Sir Alistair. Krishnam from India. Michael Collett has got in touch on Twitter to say, really enjoyed catching up on this. Well done. We've also had an email in from Derek, who says, dear Mr. Brierley, I do not believe the problem with science and many evangelical leaders actually stems from their beliefs about the Bible. John Walton, PhD, with his Lost World series published by IVP, an evangelical association, has shown that proper interpretation of Genesis presents no conflict with the material physical claims of science. I'm confident that the well-educated leaders of the evangelical movement know this, since many of them have advanced degrees in the Bible. I think the issue instead is more of a political one. You see, the number one tenet of the Republican Party is laissez-faire capitalism. Inference with their ideal model comes from regulation on corporations. Regulations are initiated by scientific information showing that certain corporations are devastating with pollution, the environment, and human health. When it comes to Christians, opinion leaders misinform their flock of innocent sheep that science is from the devil, since it contradicts the Bible's account of creation. It's not by accident that this aligns with the anti-regulation platform of the Republican Party. Innocent sheep will interpret Genesis in the way that they're guided to interpret it. Thus, despite the very first mandate in Scripture that humans were created to wisely steward God's creation, Genesis 1:28-30, innocent people are taught by the leaders who know better that scientific claims of climate change are a hoax. This creates a voting block of innocent sheep who are eager to please God against any political institution using science as initiator of corporate regulation as part of its platform. This is the reason, in my opinion, that so many churches fight against the public health restrictions of this pandemic. For generations, they've been taught by opinion leaders that science is our enemy. So the knee-jerk reaction to the pandemic has been to call it a hoax and continue business as usual. They're only doing what they've been taught to do. This is religious manipulation for the political gain of a voting bloc. It should be called a deception from the highest rooftops. Thank you so much for that, Derek. A few people have mentioned Alistair McGrath's love of C.S. Lewis, and Fabian Maldonado got in touch over Twitter to say, I have yet to hear Alistair McGrath speak without mentioning C.S. Lewis's great quote, I believe in God as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else, and it never gets old. Also on Twitter, @WhenBeliefDies got in touch to say, hey Ruth Jackson, very excited to hear about the upcoming podcast with Alistair McGrath. When is it due to start? Can't wait, TBH. Thank you to you both, @UnbelievableJB and his wife, for yesterday's live stream. Very thought-provoking. Well, we haven't actually got a concrete date yet, but we will be launching a podcast with Alistair McGrath about C.S. Lewis in the new year. So if you didn't hear that on the live stream, you're hearing it now. Very exciting news. And as soon as we know more information about timings, we will let you know. Got some comments here about the Critical Race Theory podcast a couple of weeks ago. American Idol got in touch over Twitter to say, Razzle Berry on Unbelievable has been one of my favourite guests over the past 5 years since I've been listening. The importance of compassion is so vital. Thank you for sharing that word. And we've had an email in from Jeffrey Jones who says, Dear Justin Brierley, last weekend's episode was another of the best yet. I am so grateful to you for having black guests on more often and for hosting important conversations about race. Thank you for getting in touch about all of those. We've also had some comments about the Pathos blogs. One of the most recent blogs is from Dave Rubin talking about why he is no longer an atheist. And there's sort of been mixed comments about this blog. Krishnam says on Twitter, this is one of my favourites. Those who genuinely seek answers will find God and find Christ when they search for one. However, Kevin Avec Culture on Facebook has said, this is the same as any Rubin content, lukewarm, pseudo-intellectualism and generally uninteresting. I hope Lennox still goes out and talks with people that don't immediately stroke their own egos by pretending to understand and automatically agree with everything that's said. And then I suppose one that's sort of in the middle somewhere, Tom Newman got in touch on Twitter to say, "Very interesting article. Rubin and Peterson seem to be wrestling with a sort of political spiritualism, which is neither fully religious nor totally conservative. It's an interesting stew of politics and metaphysics. I'm left wondering if it's going to carve out its own niche." And then one final comment on this, which is kind of a testimony that came up on Facebook from Tam Daniel Decker, who obviously read the blog Dave Rubin, Why I'm No Longer an Atheist, and says, "Because Jordan Peterson is brilliant and explained God in a way that Dave found enlightening, I have found renewed faith listening to Jordan too." Finally, some comments about the Douglas Murray blog, also on Pathos, which talks about the fact that he is maybe a Christian atheist. Now, Shane McKee said, "I don't know much about Douglas, but I spent quite a bit of time over the years in Nazareth, and I think I know what he means. I'm very happy to call myself a Christian atheist. In many ways, my atheism grew out of my Christianity. Yes, that process involved finding flaws, foibles, fables, and falsehoods in the Bible, but that only makes it more real as a human document. Did the miracles of Jesus happen? It's the wrong question. It doesn't matter. We're all Jesus and Judas and Joseph and Hosea and Herod. If you go to the White Mosque in Nazareth at the right time of the year, the imam will bring you delicious mishmish and welcome you in to look around and even pray. This is how we should treat each other, regardless of all the stories we tell ourselves." Dana W. doesn't necessarily agree. They say, "Christian atheist is as much an oxymoron as kosher pork." And finally, Ratstar770 says, "I think my dad was a Christian atheist. He was constantly debating with people, arguing in favour of evolution and against the concept of heaven. Yet, he was very Christian in his values, as he treated his fellow man kindly and upheld himself to the highest moral standards. And although he didn't believe in Jesus as a deity, he admired Jesus as a man. When The Passion came out, he watched the film with rapt attention. Someone told me that they saw him sitting in church one day, and it wouldn't surprise me if he was trying to hear the voice of God to change his mind once and for all." Well, thank you so much for being a part of my first ever Unbelievable. And do come back next week when Justin will be looking at conversion and deconversion. One of Justin's guests will be Jana Harmon, who's recently completed a PhD focusing on atheists who've become Christians. And Jana will be joined by Joel Furches, who has been studying the phenomenon of deconversion. And don't forget, you can get in touch with us unbelievable@premier.org.uk or on social media at unbelievablejb. Thank you so much and see you next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.